Hi, I'm Mel Majoros. I am a 2-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. Ovarian cancer is sometimes known as the silent killer because its symptoms are similar to gastrointestinal problems such as feeling full or a stomach ache. Those are the symptoms that Carrie Fitzmaurice had, and she went to her doctor. Her doctor was very proactive, and she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Carrie wanted to find a unique way to raise awareness for ovarian cancer, and she founded Teal Toes.
Today we're talking ovarian cancer. It is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. I'm talking to Carrie Fitzmaurice. She's an ovarian cancer survivor and founder of Teal Toes. How are you today, Carrie?
I am great, thanks.
So I want to jump right in and tell me how you found out you had ovarian cancer and, you know, give us a little bit of story about yourself.
Okay. It was January of 2006, and I found out that some relatively distant cousins of mine over in the UK had been part of a study and found that the breast cancer gene was present in our family, and I started looking into getting tested.
The BRCA gene, the BRCA gene, that is popularly known as the breast cancer gene, yes.
Mm-hmm. But I did not realize at the time that it also causes ovarian cancer. Did you know that?
Not until they told me that I should get tested for
it. Yeah. So I had no idea. And so I had thought, okay, I knew that, you know, I might potentially be at risk for that. But it came down through my father's father's father. So, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of near female relatives there to have been affected. But, you know, I kind of chalked that up. Okay, I need to watch out for breast cancer. I'll tell my gynecologist the next time I see her. Well, I was trying to get pregnant again. And so I think I may have been paying more attention than the average to my body. And in February, I felt as if maybe I had a urinary tract infection. So I went in to the doctor, gave a sample. She called me a couple days later and said, there's nothing wrong. You know, your sample was perfectly fine. Why did you think that this was a problem? And I told her that I had felt the pain. And she said, okay, my last patient is at 4 o'clock today. You come in at 4:30. So I did. And she gave me a pelvic exam and felt something on, I believe, both of my ovaries.
Did she just do the pelvic or the transvaginal?
She did the pelvic. She was a solo practitioner, and she did not have the ultrasound equipment available in her office.
Okay.
So she wrote me a referral for an ultrasound. I went downstairs, called. They weren't going to be able to see me for a month. I went back upstairs. She called in on the doctor number and was able to get them to see me within a couple of days.
Nice.
So, yes. So, long story short, and she told me while she was doing this that she had read Gilda Radner's autobiography and would rather have unnecessary imaging than potentially miss
because
something.
Because you don't know. You can't, I mean, no one ever goes, hooray, it's cancer, you know?
Exactly, exactly. But she, she had put it to me originally. She doesn't like unexplained pain and had me come in right away. So, I was very lucky. I have a particularly, you know, lucky story when it comes to ovarian cancer diagnosis compared to a lot of women.
And a very proactive doctor, and you're very proactive yourself. I mean, everybody has to be, and it's very surprising that some people aren't.
Not to jump ahead, but the Ovarian Cancer National Alliance has a fabulous program called Survivors Teaching Students, wherein we survivors go into medical schools, and when medical students, sometimes it's nurses, sometimes it's PA students, are doing their gynecological rotation, and we tell them our stories. And many of the women that I've been sort of up there telling the stories with have not had as good a diagnosis experience as I have. They've had the typical ovarian cancer run around, you know, testing here, testing there, thinking it's some GI issue, some other issue potentially, and it's months before they actually get an answer to why they're not quite feeling right. So I was very lucky. Within 5 weeks of my first feeling a twinge, I was on the operating table with a gynecological oncologist, extremely important there, you have to see a gynecological oncologist. Basically, that gives you a better... They know rather than just a general surgeon or rather than just a gynecologist who may do some surgery, a gynecological oncologist, say that 10 times fast,
yeah, exactly.
Especially with chemo brain. A gynecological oncologist is trained specifically for doing the debulking surgery, which is what they call opening you up and getting out all of the cancer they possibly can.
Oh, I see.
And that is highly correlated with much better outcomes. In other words, women who have gone to a gynecological oncologist for their surgery tend to survive longer than women who have not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I didn't know
so that. Yes, very, very important for anybody who, God forbid, might be dealing with a possible ovarian cancer diagnosis to have their surgery done by a gynecological oncologist. And there is certainly, you know, there's not one in every town. So
right.
I actually have met women who were opened up. It was seen what they were facing, and they were closed up again to be, you know, to be transferred to some place larger where they could be seen by a gynecological oncologist.
Who made you say that five times fast?
Yes, exactly. Who then, one of the things they did at the time was they sort of wash you out with some sort of chemo-type agent at the time while they're actually performing the surgery to try to get everything out.
Right.
So they took out everything, the ovaries, the uterus, the omentum. I didn't even know I had an omentum, and here it was gone.
What is it?
It's the fatty covering that's kind of over that whole pelvic region.
Mm.
So it's like under your belly fat, but above your, I think I have that right.
Well, they should have just gotten rid of your belly fat.
Well, that came later. You're jumping ahead of things here. Yeah, so I did that, and then I went through six rounds of regular old chemo,
mm-hmm.
and then I had intraperitoneal chemo, which was just transferring at that time in 2006 from having been something that had been mostly done with people as on a trial basis to, although I have met some women who had it 20 years ago, to now I think it's pretty much the standard of care. And in this, they put a port into your abdomen.
Oh.
It's actually higher than I would have expected. It's kind of right under my rib cage, and they dump chemo directly into the
right.
abdomen.
Okay, I had a port in my heart to go into.
Yes,
that. Mm-hmm. That's where
I
they
have
usually
one there
put the
for
port
regular
in.
Intravenous chemo, but then they put in another one that goes directly into your abdomen, and so they pump this stuff in, and you kind of lie there, and then
mm-hmm.
you have to turn over and lie on the other side. Sort of you slosh around for a while as it works its way through. So again, that's now become the standard of care because they found that tends to women who've had intraperitoneal chemo, if they should have a recurrence, they generally don't get it in their abdomen.
Oh, now did you? What was your stage?
Stage 3C.
Okay, what is a C? What does that mean?
I don't remember exactly what the C part means. The
mm-hmm.
3 means that it had not yet escaped the abdomen, but it was all over the abdominal cavity.
I don't like it when they keep adding stuff to it, because that, you know.
I know, yeah, you're right. I need to look up again exactly what the C stands for. I don't remember that part. Chemo brain and everything. I think I've completely blocked that part out.
Now, you didn't have to have radiation, did you?
I did not have to have radiation, no. Because of the location, you generally don't see that quite as much with ovarian cancer. And frankly, I think that's also part of where the intraperitoneal stuff comes in. You know,
okay.
they've like washed everything with the chemo instead of having to radiate it.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I spent a whole year with no evidence of disease.
Excellent.
During that time, I did officially, we operated under the assumption that I did have my family's gene.
Mm-hmm.
I did get tested. My family's gene, if I can go off on the BRCA tangent
yes,
for a minute, my family's gene had been newly discovered in 2005. So if I had any reason to have been tested prior to that, they wouldn't have found anything.
Oh.
In fact, if I had been tested pretty much any time up to, I think they've now added it to the regular screen, but without my cousin's results, so they knew precisely what to look for, they also would have come up with nothing. It's relatively new, and I don't know, because since they haven't done widespread screening of folks with it, I don't know too many people they know that have had this particular mutation outside my rather large family, my rather large extended family.
I see.
So, knowing that I had the gene, I decided I wanted a prophylactic mastectomy. I did not want to have cancer again.
Right.
I had gone in for a mammogram, and that meant mammogram, then go back for more imaging. Then they say, oh, I think we want to do an ultrasound. Then they say, oh, I think we want to do a biopsy. And enough of those, and you think, heck, I'm getting a mastectomy by biopsy. I might as well just go through the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. What, did they find something?
Well, no, all of the stuff they found was benign, and they told me that they were being pretty proactive because of my genetic history and whatnot. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of data on if you have the gene and you get ovarian cancer first, what your risk is for then getting breast cancer. Because unfortunately, there have not been a whole lot of women with ovarian cancer who've survived long enough for them to figure it out.
Okay.
Survival rates for ovarian cancer haven't been great. They are getting better with a lot of these latest things that have been found, IP chemo and some things like that. But there's not a whole lot. I mean, there are like 2 journal articles out there that address what your breast cancer risk might be if you had ovarian cancer first.
Well, I think it's also just awareness for your ovarian cancer, too, because I know last year we had a local OBGYN, and he said it's the same kind of symptoms as if you had a bad meal. Or like a week. Or it can be. Those are some of the symptoms.
It can be, yes. There are some groups, let's see, sort of internationally within the English-speaking world. Well, the European consensus statement on symptoms is slightly different from the U.S. one. But in general, they've come up with a new acronym. It's BEAT, B-E-A-T, and that stands for bloating that is persistent, eating less and feeling fuller, abdominal pain, and trouble with your bladder.
Oh.
And they're working on piloting some online, or not necessarily online, but some journals, symptom journals, that women can tell when they've had these symptoms. So they can track it to if it happens at a particular time of the month, or they can track it to a particular thing that they ate to help narrow some things down.
Right, right.
Okay, so let's see. I just got distracted. Where was I in my story? Oh, right. So I decided I wanted a prophylactic mastectomy, did not want to have cancer again. I went to see the top breast surgeon at the original institution where I had been treated, thinking that, what the heck, I might as well do everything all in one place. It'll make sharing records easier and all of that.
2-for-1 discount, maybe? No.
Well, that would have been nice, yes. I've been told by some of her colleagues afterwards that perhaps she just didn't understand fully about BRCA and the statistics therein and that type of thing, but she refused to do the surgery because she thought that statistically, I had been cleared by my medical team to be able to stand the physically go through the surgery and all that kind of thing. Well, she thought that I was statistically at greater risk of having an ovarian cancer recurrence, and she wanted me to wait at least a couple of years before having the prophylactic mastectomy.
Did you go somewhere else?
Yes.
Okay.
But then I did have to go through all the record transfer, and, that can lead us down a rabbit hole of
would it be great to have easily
electronic records and all that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So by the time I got all that kind of stuff transferred over, met with the surgeon, met with the plastic surgeon that I wanted to have, I was scheduled for, they couldn't squeeze me in for a little bit, and I decided August wasn't the greatest time to do it, so we scheduled it for the fall. Well, of course, my 1 year of having no evidence of disease ended in September of 2007, which was right before my surgery had been scheduled.
Oh.
And at that point, I went on the Avastin trial.
So how did they find it again? Blood tests?
I was having routine blood checks and CT scans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I went on the Avastin trial so I couldn't have surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Avastin seemed to be working great. Come January, February or so, now we're into 2008, routine CT as part of being on the Avastin trial showed a mass in the breast.
Oh, no.
Fortunately, my CTs were being read by an expert in both breast and ovarian cancer, so she knew what she was looking at.
Oh, that's good.
So I had to get off the Avastin trial, transfer back and then we had to, get a biopsy, transfer everything back over to the institution where I was going to, where I was already in with the breast surgeon and all that type of thing. And I ended up with stage 2B breast cancer.
Did you go back to that surgeon and be like,
I have. don't get me started.
Okay.
I have tried to put that behind me, mm-hmm. other than, you know, in terms of telling my story, because the breast surgeon that did operate on me said that she has used me as anecdotal evidence when she's been in conversations about this whole strict surveillance regimen, because I was 4 months. It happened pretty much right in between scans, 4 months from one and 2 months until the other under my strict surveillance regime for the breasts, that I ended up with stage 2B breast cancer. Yes,
wow.
Lymph node involvement, the whole nine yards.
Ugh.
So not to mention the fact, I mean, which was almost worse, was the fact that I had to get off of my treatment for ovarian cancer in order to deal with the breast cancer. And then I couldn't get back on the Avastin trial, so I went back into regular old chemo. Oh, so this is where the tummy tuck comes in. I had the deep flap reconstruction for the breast.
Okay.
With the whole tummy tuck thing.
Oh.
That part was fabulous, yes. The bad part about the breast cancer, I have to say, is the fact that I cannot use my right arm for blood pressure. I can't get blood, you know, any of that
kind of stuff. I have the same thing. I mean, I had no lymph node involvement, but, you know, I'm not going to risk it for blood pressure or anything like that.
Right. Then I was no evidence of a disease for about 6 months, and then my CA-125 popped up just a little bit.
Which is for ovarian cancer.
That's the blood marker for ovarian cancer, which is not predictive in everybody, but in me it seems to be a pretty good predictor.
Okay.
Mine had been about somewhere in the 4-digit range when I was first diagnosed, and it got back down to about 6 or 7 during the times that I had no evidence of disease. It popped back up, I think it was 51, when I started on the PARP inhibitor trial last fall. And so I had 8 rounds of carboplatinum, and I take the PARP. I still take the PARP inhibitor twice a day. And so far, so good. My tumor has shrunk at least 53%, and my CA-125 is back down to, it bops around between 6, 7, 8, somewhere in that range.
So they can't operate? Not right now while you're on chemo?
It is. They are in non-operable places.
I wasn't aware they were. Oh. I see.
They know where they were. The current tumors are on the para-aortic.
Oh.
They're in the para-aortic lymph node system.
Okay.
And so there's one near my diaphragm, one near my heart, and then the one that they were able to biopsy is kind of in a funky place under my collarbone. Not the most fun biopsy, but
no,
yeah.
I can imagine. So how did this all start, Teal Toes? Tell me that.
I went to the Ovarian Cancer National Alliance Conference.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I went to the first one I went to was in 2006 when I was undergoing chemo, and mm-hmm. I was only able to attend the last day, which I really wanted to do because Sue Friedman, the founder of FORCE, Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered, which is the best source that I found for anything having to do with the breast cancer gene,
okay.
was speaking, and so I really wanted to go. So that was the first one I went to. And then in 2007, I was able to go and participate in the whole thing.
Excellent.
And one of the things that they were giving out were these little temporary tattoos of little teal ribbons, and ladies were putting them on their feet. And I think I probably had seen a couple of women who had painted their fingers and their toes were teal. Everybody was wearing teal. It was a definite teal fest. And I was thinking, if I've got this teal ribbon tattoo on my foot, heck, I should go find some teal nail polish and put that on too. So I did that. That was July. And then come September, when I found out about the recurrence, I decided also, since it was ovarian cancer awareness month, I was going to paint my toenails teal. So I showed up at my kid's bus stop, the elementary school bus stop, with teal toes, and the other moms, knowing that, you know, nail polish on my toes was not something they had seen me wear that often, asked what it was all about, and by the end of that week, they all had teal toes as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then there were a couple of school events for back to school, and ended up, you know, there were more of the women had teal toes, and I realized that this thing had legs.
So to speak.
No pun intended. For that December, my husband made me a gift of the tealtoes.org domain name.
Excellent.
And I put together a website, and after he realized that it really was going somewhere, he redid it for me in a more professional manner.
Awesome.
And found a law firm that was willing to help me out pro bono doing the nonprofit filing. So I incorporated and got nonprofit status from the IRS, and that brings us up to where we are now.
Awesome. And what kind of fundraisers do you do?
Teal Toes exists mainly as an awareness raiser.
Okay.
There are so many fabulous organizations out there that raise funds and are, right. you know, in a much better position to do that type of thing. I encourage people, if they want to do something, you know, find a local chapter of one of the main ovarian cancer organizations or mm-hmm. women's programs at their local hospital, that type of thing. I certainly do accept donations and take in some of them because, as my husband keeps reminding me, we have been largely self-funded.
Right.
The main thing that we do is send out symptom cards. They have the Tiltoe, their business card size. They have the Tiltoe's logo on one side and the ovarian cancer symptoms on the other. And they're perfect for keeping in your pocket, your wallet, whatever, so that when you're standing in the grocery checkout line and somebody asks about your toes, you can whip out a card and hand it to them. And then they now know they have the symptoms of ovarian cancer and, you know, they've had potentially a little chat about it. I've had many, again, local chapters of some of the, of either the Ovarian Cancer National Alliance or the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition use Teal Toes as one of their local fundraisers. They have pedicure parties or toes and teeny parties or, you know, various things like that to raise money for their local other educational efforts and for some of their local hospital programs and that kind of thing. And I think that's just fabulous.
Okay, so Teal Toes, if people want to get a hold of you, Carrie, how can they get a hold of you?
Try saying that 10 times fast. www.tealtoes.org.
Okay, and you have a lot of other organizations here on your page.
Yes.
That anyone can go to.
Yes, I have links to a lot of the national ones on the Facebook page for Teal Toes, which
yes.
is facebook.com/Teal Toes. I have links to a lot of the local organizations, the local chapters of various things that also deal with ovarian cancer. I have links to them from the Facebook page for Teal Toes.
Excellent. And as a cancer advocate, I also want to make sure that ladies and guys, well, ovarian cancer obviously doesn't strike guys, but, you know, if there's ever anything that you feel is odd or different with your body, definitely talk to your doctor. Because,
yes.
you know, like you were saying, if you had waited, we might not be having this conversation.
Exactly. I mean, if I was stage 3C by the time I really felt the first thing that I, you know, could mark down as a symptom. Now, if I had known the ovarian cancer symptoms right. in advance, would I have noticed them more? I'm not sure. I mean, I was only 37 when I was diagnosed,
right.
which is also a hallmark of it being genetic, that you tend to be younger.
Okay.
But if I had known of my genetic risk as well as the symptoms, then I do think that I might have noticed things maybe a couple of months sooner.
And I didn't know this, and, you know, we can make the listeners aware that a Pap test does not test for ovarian cancer, which...
Correct. The three sort of misconceptions I hear about the most are, well, weren't you getting your Pap smears? No, that
right.
checks for cervical cancer. And then folks ask about Gardasil, which is fabulous, but that's also for cervical cancer. That's the vaccine that's been in the news in the last few years, also for cervical cancer. And then the third thing being that people don't realize that there is a link between breast and ovarian cancer,
right.
especially if it's genetic. Yeah.
And you can always ask your doctor for a pelvic exam, which also includes the transvaginal ultrasound, which does, it's quite invasive, let's just say that, as you can tell by the name, but it does get a good look at your ovaries.
Yes. I know you have some of your other podcasts have gotten into a little more detail about what transvaginal ultrasound actually entails. But yes, now that many, especially the larger gynecological practices, have the equipment right there in the office,
right.
it's much less of a big deal. I mean, as far as, you know, not having to fill out more paperwork, get a referral, all that type of thing, to actually just go ahead and have one and just be sure, especially if you know that there is some sort of potential genetic risk. And so if a woman knows that in her family there has been breast and or ovarian cancer in any of her female relatives, especially at a
right.
relatively young age, so say under 60, I think it's under under 45 or so for breast and under 50 or so for ovarian, then that's something to potentially consider. Another thing I have found out talking to women, our grandmothers or maybe great-grandmothers generation, since they didn't really talk about this kind of stuff.
Right.
If you know your great-grandmother had what was, you know, maybe called stomach cancer, or she died of some sort of female complications or something. I've talked to a lot of people who, now that they know their family's genetic history, figure that's probably what she had, but either nobody knew or it just wasn't talked about, a lot of that kind of thing.
Right. And if you're unhappy with your doctor, then I always say go to another doctor.
Definitely. I've had cousins who've been told, oh, don't worry, you can't get the gene because you can't get it from your father. Well, that definitely right there is time to switch to another doctor.
Yeah, you can't get the gene from your dad.
You can get it from either one. Yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's your genes. It doesn't mean...
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
In this day and age, yeah, believe it or not, yeah.
And I'm just always surprised about people who are not as proactive as, you know, now, unfortunately, you and I have to be, you know. And even some cancer survivors that I've met, they're like, well, my doctor didn't tell me that. It's just like, okay, I think my doctor, like, you know, she actually told me, she's like, well, you're more proactive than most of my patients. You know, but it's like, okay, well, I want to know if there's something wrong with me. I usually just like study it up and then I'll ask all these questions and everything. And, you know, it's your body. There's only one.
Well, for all that you hear, maybe potentially horror stories or people freaking themselves out or whatever by diagnosing themselves via the web, there, in some ways, there's kind of no excuse anymore. We do have all of this fabulous information at our disposal. So once you know, you know, potentially something, it's that much easier to search for a specialist in that area.
Right, exactly.
It's that much easier to find out potential side effects, to find out what to do afterwards, you know, long-term effect. A lot of that kind of stuff is,
exactly,
I think, much easier now than it used to be.
And we don't want you to diagnose yourself on WebMD, though.
No, I'm certainly not advocating that, but yes, but knowing, and that's why I think, to go back to the Survivors Teaching Students program, I think that type of thing is really important, because making the average person aware, that's great. If it helps even just one woman maybe find something sooner than she might have otherwise, then everything I'm doing here will have been useful. But truly educating the next generation of doctors, of nurses, of physicians' assistants to keep this in the back of their mind. When they're presented with a woman who may have some of these symptoms, some of these complaints, yes, it could very easily be some sort of gastrointestinal thing, but in the back of their mind, they will remember seeing these women, you know, that may be their mother's age, maybe just a little bit older than them, that type of thing, talking about the journey that they went through to get diagnosed, and they may think, maybe I'll go ahead and order a transvaginal ultrasound on this woman. Maybe I'll go ahead and order that blood test. And so I think that will help.
And honestly, you know, unless they're testing you for something, I don't know, outrageous, I guess I'm not a doctor, so, you know, don't listen to me, but I don't think any test after you have cancer is outrageous.
Oh, certainly not after you have cancer. No, I'm thinking about, you know, the general population. Yes. And then certainly after you have cancer, nothing is right. And that's also,
like, you
want to
do what? Drive me down the street and then drive me through the MRI? Sure. Okay. Is it going to check for something?
Oh, I think I've had an ultrasound of just about every part of my body except maybe my head.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Do they ultrasound heads?
I'm not sure. That might be just an MRI thing.
That might be another show,
but
I'll have to look into.
Yeah, I ended up with my initial debulking surgery was so long, I ended up with a clot and a pulmonary embolism. And so before going into surgery for the mastectomy, I did have to go have my legs ultrasounded to make sure there weren't any clots lurking in them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think I've had just about everything ultrasounded at this point. So, yeah.
Well, we're glad you're here, Carrie, for sure.
Thank you.
And it's tealtoes.org, and you can also find it on Facebook.
And September is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. It is also the awareness month for a variety of other cancers, but heck, unfortunately, we have more cancers than we have months of the year.
Yes,
someday
true.
We might well change that, but at the moment, that's the way it is. And so, yeah, September is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. I guess I should say, I don't know how international your audience is. It's Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month in the U.S. and Canada.
Right.
Australia does February, and the UK and Ireland are in March.
Oh, I didn't know that. So this is the one month, and I'm a hockey fan, that I'll allow people to wear a San Jose Sharks jersey.
Well, see, there you go.
So.
Yes, and we're trying to, we've reached out to try to partner with them to do some things, because the National Hockey League does have their cancer
right, their hockey
program.
Fights cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've reached out thinking that the Sharks would be the natural ones to help out on ovarian cancer.
Awesome. Well, that's great info, yes. Carrie. I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. This is The Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. You can become a fan of the show, The Cancer Warrior, on EmpowerRadio.com on Facebook. Check out my blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And you know what? Life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.